Thank you. The panel was previously called. Both of you have been here before. Just a reminder, there is a time clock in my upper left-hand screen. If you go over that, I'll probably remind you that you have appellate counsel. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin making your statement. I'll ask our marshal to call the next case for remote consideration.
Calling A23-0928, A23-0930, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Jeremy Scott Jenkins, Appellant.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm from the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing Jeremy Jenkins on this case. During a period of family strife, EJ first alleged that her father, Mr. Jenkins, had sexually abused her years before. The state's case rested entirely on EJ's testimony. But there were grounds to doubt EJ's testimony. A psychological report had found EJ had trouble telling reality from fantasy. Years before accusing Mr. Jenkins, EJ had claimed another family had sexually abused her, only to later deny this abuse. This evidence would have given the jury reason to doubt EJ's reliability and to doubt Mr. Jenkins' guilt, but the jury never heard any of it. This evidence could have influenced the jury because of the weakness of EJ's trial testimony. She mostly provided brief responses to the prosecutor's leading or binary questions. A fair trial should have presented the jury with evidence calling EJ's reliability into question, which the jury could have weighed against EJ's trial testimony. But a fair trial did not happen due to three major errors that distorted the jury's evaluation of EJ's reliability. First, the state violated Brady and due process by withholding the psychological report that found EJ had trouble telling fantasy from reality and had difficulty perceiving events accurately. This kept the jury from considering whether EJ perceived things that were real or imagined. Second, the court erred by allowing the state to use EJ's pretrial interview to cure EJ's deficient trial testimony. This error allowed the jury to find Mr. Jenkins guilty based on out-of-court hearsay statements rather than EJ's limited trial testimony. And third, the court erred by precluding the defense from offering evidence that EJ had made prior false statements about sexual abuse by other family members.
Mr. McLaughlin, here's my start question. You've
Sure.
got the Brady violation, you've got some evidentiary rulings. And my question to you is this: if we agree that there was a Brady violation, is this court in a position where we need to answer to the evidentiary rulings, the forensic interview as well as the prior assertions that there was abuse?
No, if this court finds a reversible Brady violation, I don't think the court needs to reach those other two issues. If any of the three issues is dispositive, so if the court agrees on any of the three issues, I think that's a sufficient basis to reverse.
Well, let's talk about the Brady violation. Obviously, everyone agrees the state did not give a disclosure in this case because your client, the dad, was aware, knew that his child was incompetent. That being the case, how is that material? In other words, what I'm getting at is he indicates, yes, I knew she was incompetent. Is he asserting that he didn't get the basis for her incompetency? In other words, she was maybe too young, maybe under the influence of a mood-altering chemical. Is that what you're arguing?
Right, the Brady material is really the specific findings in that competency report that EJ had trouble differentiating fantasy from reality and difficulty perceiving events. And Mr. Jenkins' assertion is that he never received the written report containing that finding. He was aware of the general finding that she was not competent, but not that specific basis that rested on her perception difficulties. And so the fact that he knew she was competent wasn't sufficient to
So
cure the Brady
the fact
violation.
that he knew she was incompetent, is that not enough for him then to have made that inquiry and that demand of the state or to have alerted his trial counsel to that?
Our position is that it is not. I mean, the state has an affirmative obligation under Brady to disclose this material, and. If that general rule applies in this case, there's no question that the state
Well, it's kind of
can.
an interesting conundrum because, let's say 15 years had passed. Is the state Is there a rule? Is there something that you can point me to that says in each and every case when there is a prosecution, the state has to then repeat again the Brady disclosure? I mean, at some point, does it wash away that there be any recall of that violation?
Well, I mean, the limit is that it has to be exculpatory or impeaching, and it has to be, it has to be exculpatory or impeaching. So, I mean, to the extent that it was so old that it would no longer be exculpatory or impeaching, the state would be relieved of an obligation. But other than that, there's no time limit on the state's obligation under
So
Brady.
what was the time frame here in terms of when your client acknowledges that he was told his child was incompetent and when this matter went to trial?
Well, our so. To answer your
I mean,
question,
this is clearly different from Hunt. Hunt outlined a whole set of factors where the matter went to the jury before they were apprised of the fact that there was a Rule 20 examination and finding of incompetency. So this is a little different than Hunt. We've got a passage of time.
there's a passage of time, and there is 7 years from when the exam was done until trial. So that's on one side, but we would point to that the key time frame is the amount of time that passed between the examination and when the period of alleged abuse began, because our argument is that it was Brady material because it went towards her ability to perceive the criminal event when it happened. So the relevant period is from when that criminal event started to when the examination was made. And that's a period of 2 years, 10 days from when the examination to when the alleged abuse began. So
Laughlin, I have a little bit of a different question, but about the same topic. I understand your argument as to materiality. My question is about the prejudice piece of it, because if father was aware that this competency evaluation was out there or that daughter had been somehow found incompetent before, how can he say he was prejudiced by the lack of disclosure? He knew that that was an issue.
our position is that he did know that she was found not competent, but he did not know that a psychologist had made a professional finding that she had trouble distinguishing reality from fantasy. So that's
Again,
the
you're going back to he didn't know why she was incompetent. He just knew she was incompetent.
right. And it's really not the competency finding that we're saying is Brady material in itself. It's the psychological finding she couldn't distinguish fantasy from reality, and that she had trouble accurately perceiving events. And precisely that type of material has been found to be Brady material, regardless of whether there's a competency finding attached to it. Any psychological finding that someone has trouble distinguishing reality from fantasy is Brady
We don't
material.
have a court order in this case on the Brady issue from the trial court that talks about the findings. Is that necessary for our review? I mean, in fact, we don't have findings on that, and we have a evidentiary ruling without benefit of looking at what the evidence was. So what do we do with all of that?
The post-conviction court's order is deficient, and
It's about two sentences, if I recall, in reading it.
and it's part of a pattern in our view in this case. I mean, you look at the Brady issue, look at the way the court analyzed the prior consistent statement issue. It stated at trial that it didn't even view the video, which is impossible, which makes any comparison of the trial testimony and the video impossible for terms of determining whether they're consistent. So it's part of a pattern of this district court. Our view is that this court owes no deference to that post-conviction order because it lacks any legal analysis, and it's based on a erroneous legal belief that if a witness is incredible, that that's affirmative proof of a fact. So this court owes no
But
deference to it.
are we in a position where we have to weigh the evidence, though, as far as whether the record supports this incompetency from 2 years prior to when there was a court hearing, or do we have to send it back and have Judge Melby again approach this and make that determination?
I mean, the court has authority to do either. We'd
But of course,
ask,
you want us to reverse it
well,
outright and have a new trial.
yes, and part of that is because I mean, there were evidentiary hearings. There was a full record that was developed in post-conviction. So even though the order itself lacks any substance, there is substance in the record that was developed that we feel the court could use to reach the merits on the Brady claim. And the court does review Brady claims de novo as a general matter, although it defers to factual findings made by the post-conviction court. So we do think it is appropriate for the court to reach the issue, but if it doesn't, I mean, we prefer a remand rather to an outright affirming the opinion, but we do think there's enough for the court to reach the Brady issue here. And just to make one more point about the whole question of whether Mr. Jenkins received the report. Again, as we argue fully in the brief, it's our position that the record does not show he received it. But,
well, we can infer from the record evidence that he received it. I mean, you have this examiner that's saying, look, this is what I do. I stick it in the mail. I send it out. And there's nothing to dispute that. I mean, certainly we can infer that he received it.
I mean, our view is that there's no direct evidence about whether it was mailed. No, the state could have called someone to testify that they mailed it to Mr. Jenkins. They did not. So what we have is a set of circumstantial evidence regarding whether it was mailed or not. And the circumstances that show it was not mailed include that Mr. Jenkins never at any time referenced any of the contents of the written report, even though he was repeatedly and trying to convince social workers that EJ had a pattern of lying. He never brought up that a psychologist had found she couldn't distinguish truth from fiction. There's no one ever saw Mr. Jenkins in possession of the report. The Dr. Hagen had a policy of following Rule 2001 in his office, and Rule 21 prohibited Mr. Jenkins from receiving the report prior to the competency hearing. So if it had been mailed out to him, it would have been in violation of Rule 20, and Dr. Hagen said that his office followed Rule 20. So there were circumstances pointing to him not getting that report. And again, the only fact that post-conviction court relied on was that Mr. Jenkins was not credible, but that is not affirmative proof that he received it. It's just all that would establish is that the court shouldn't give any weight to his testimony that he did receive it. But taking those factual issues aside too, it's notable that this exception to the general state's obligation to disclose helpful material where the defendant has it in the possession, that's never been recognized in Minnesota. That's an exception that's been recognized in several circuits in the federal case law. But that exception is also more limited than the state presents it. And the important limitations are that it looks at whether that material was possessed by the defendant at the time of trial. Here, the state has offered no evidence to show Mr. Jenkins still had it at the time of trial. And in fact, all the circumstances suggest he did not have it. Otherwise, he would have shared it with his attorney. And the other requirement in that exception is that the only reason it wasn't presented to the court has to be because the defendant failed to exercise due diligence. Here, Mr. Jenkins would have been legally barred from introducing that report if he had it, because he would have obtained it illegally in violation of Rule 2001. And disclosure of confidential juvenile information can only be done by a valid court order that's needed to vindicate the defendant's constitutional rights. So he couldn't have legally have offered it based on it, even if he had received it in 2016. So the only reason he offered it was not based on a lack of due diligence. So that exception doesn't apply. And again, Minnesota hasn't ever recognized it. So the district court relied on an exception that's in no Minnesota case without citing even to the federal cases that the state cited. And just turning briefly to the other two issues, in our view, it's part of a pattern in this case that the jury didn't get all this information that was there to question whether EJ was reliable. And really all we're asking for is a new trial to give the jury a chance to fairly weigh all of the evidence here, both the Brady material and the evidence of prior allegations of false statements regarding sexual abuse. And again, the court's ruling on the prior consistent statement is especially problematic. This court in the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated that before evidence is admitted as a prior consistent statement,
you're talking about the forensic interview now?
Yes. That evidence, the court needs to do a comparison of the trial testimony and the out-of-court statement. That comparison is necessary to determine whether the trial statements are consistent with what the witness said previously. Here, the court admitted it did not perform that comparison because it never watched the video.
We don't have findings by the trial court which indicated that it hadn't reviewed the video. So what do we do with that?
I mean, it's said on the record, in the trial record on page 117, well, I haven't seen the video. It didn't come up at pretrial for me to watch the video, so I didn't watch the video. And that was it. He said that in response to defense counsel making an objection that the evidence was not admissible as a prior consistent statement. That was the court's response. So, I mean, That is, the court did not weigh the relevant factors because it could not have without viewing the video. So that's a clear evidentiary error that happened. The state's entire case depended on EJ's credibility and the reliability of her testimony. And so that the error was prejudicial. So this court alone could sidestep the whole Brady question and just reverse based on that alone. And I think there are enough questions in this case with all the stuff that was kept out and the risk that the jury looked at this video instead of the limited things EJ actually testified to, all the evidence that could have been used to question EJ's reliability that the jury never saw. There's enough here to give a fair chance to have the jury take a fresh look at everything with all the evidence before it and decide this case fairly for Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. I cut myself off, sorry. We'll hear from you, Mr. Hamill.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Wes Vannert. I'm representing the state of Minnesota on this appeal. Thank you for your time. A lot to go over here, but I'll start with the Brady analysis here. Just the first prong, favorable because it would be exculpatory or impeaching. I completely argue that this is, there's no way, defense has never presented how they would actually use this and get past any rules of evidence that would preclude this document from being used in 2021 at the trial.
Well, doesn't it bring into question her competency at the time of the allegation against the appellant in this case? If we're talking about the findings that are a part of that evaluation.
Right, and Dr. Haugen testified that he would not rely on those so far in the future, not even a year in the future, he says he wouldn't rely on those. And so they couldn't get that document in because the doctor says it's not reliable so far into the future. So it's unfathomable to think how possibly that would have been able to be used because it was so dated. Doctor said this is typical of 9 and 10 year old children to have this finding from Rorschach test, the inkblot test, that they don't always, aren't able to differentiate between reality and fantasy. Some might still believe in Santa Claus. So the doctor said this is typical and we expect that children change and outgrow those fantasies over time. So again, I don't know how defense possibly would have used that at trial.
Trial court order on that. There's a finding that Jenkins' testimony was not credible. How does that
right.
even resolve the Brady?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you for asking. I got
totally
you. So but we can deduce from the evidence that there is no doubt that Mr. Jenkins got a copy of that. And I think Judge Melby was saying he's not credible because, and he says before that, I think on the line above that, he received a copy. So him saying he didn't receive a copy, that's not incredible. We know
he received a copy. He got a copy that she was, the child was incompetent, but that doesn't mean he got the findings. As I understand his assertion is the basis, the genesis for that determination of incompetency, which it could be many things. As I said, it could be because we don't know. Children are
so, Your Honor, if I may, I'll explain that here. So we know because on December 30th of 2016, he meets with social worker Maggie Mansky, right? On December 30th. We know from the document, the actual forensic or the evaluation, that in quotes, it says, mailed out to Judge Benchuf and Mr. Jenkins, December 20th, 2016. So 10 days before he meets with Ms. Mansky, that is mailed out to him. The hearing under Rule 21 doesn't occur until January 5th, 2017. And so Jeremy Jenkins testifies he never got a copy from Maggie Mansky, the attorney for Ellie, or anybody else. He just denies ever getting it. But on December 30th, he presents to a social worker saying she was found incompetent. The only way that he would have been able to know that is if he received a copy as designated on that report. He never talked to Dr. Haugen in between those times. There was no other way for him to know those findings, unless, as the document indicates, it was mailed out on December 20th to him. That's how he knew on December 30th before the hearing what the findings were. And that's why Judge Melby found it was not credible. And so I think it's a very valid basis for Judge Melby to make that finding because it's in line with the evidence. Defense counsel wants to argue in spite of the evidence. that he didn't get a copy, even though we have strong evidence that he did. The other thing to consider is that since that time, Mr. Jenkins was the primary caretaker of his daughter Ellie, and he took her to all of the evaluations. He talks about in 2016 all the different places, North Homes, places he was taking her. He was well aware of anything going on with her mental acuity and ability. He had the ability, she testified, and he had the ability to cross-examine her with all of his knowledge. She came across to the jurors as credible, and they believed her because there was corroboration to her story.
All right, her trial testimony. I have a copy of her trial testimony, and it's very brief and very short. Not a lot of information there. It appears to me that her testimony was significantly buttressed by the forensic interview. So tell me about that and what we deal with in terms of an evidentiary ruling without the judge having even looked at the forensic interview before it was presented.
Your Honor, so at that point, I recall at the trial, I recall having that argument. And I recall Judge Melby, I don't have it in front of me, saying the reasons why it was consistent that the ways that she was penetrated by her father on the stand were consistent with how she what she described as far as the sexual. So his finding was that.
I'm talking about when this matter goes to the jury and the jury has played this video and the judge has not halted the trial or paused the trial to review the video to see what damaging information or whether there is information that is not inherently reliable before it gets played to the jury. We don't have a court ruling. What do we do with that?
And Your Honor, again, so I understand the question. My recollection is that Judge Melby's finding was that after hearing her testimony, he knew, and I can't remember if it was from a transcript or where the information, or I don't recall him saying he didn't watch the video before that, I guess is my point, but him making a finding that she testified on the stand of the forms of penetration that she incurred by her father and knew that those were the allegations contained in the forensic interview, and that was consistent with what he suspected the forensic interview contained. And again, I don't recall exactly where Judge Melby got the information. I don't recall him saying he didn't watch the video, and I'm not saying that's not true. I don't have specifically how he knew that information. I just remember him on the record making that finding about the consistency between the sexual penetrations that she suffered from her father. And that was the main point. He didn't care about whether small things weren't. He said not, she doesn't need to say every little thing on the stand that she said in the forensic interview, basically, that the gist of it was that she was sexually assaulted by her father in certain ways, and that came through on the testimony at the trial. And you know, and I think that's accurate. The she did describe in front of these, and you're right, she's a teenager on the stand in front of these strangers, telling them how her father sexually assaulted her and penetrated her. I didn't expect her to get into as much detail as we would like, but she did. She got up there and told the jury what happened, and they found her to be credible. Mr. Jenkins had every opportunity to cross-examine her. He, from the time she was removed from his home up until the trial, continued to tell all the social workers, his attorney, "Hey, she's a liar. She's a liar. She's making this stuff up. She's not competent." And so it was never surprising. It was never prejudiced. He had every bit of knowledge about her mental diagnosis and acuity. There was never a motion or anything filed by anybody because her testimony appeared to be true. Like nobody on the jurors, the attorneys didn't question that she was making things up. And if they did, a motion could have been filed at any point in Rule 2001. But that never appeared to anybody. It was Mr. Jenkins who kept saying this because he was guilty of sexually assaulting her and wanted to paint her out to be a liar and try to reduce her credibility. And that's where all of the self-serving hearsay of him saying there was prior sexual allegations was him saying that she said these things. And that's why the court also determined that there's no way to find any truthfulness to any of these.
Counsel, should we be concerned that the forensic interview was, it wasn't just a little bit longer, it was substantially much more information, wasn't it? More detail than what EJ gave in the trial testimony. And so do we have a concern here that that it wasn't allowable because of that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Again, she testified to the elements of the crime on the stand that were contained in there. I don't know. I don't think there was any request to redact anything else. I don't see any reason that it would have been.
Well, how could anything have been redacted, because there was no ruling on that until after the video was played? This really disturbs me, because I think it's just proven practice. You pause and you see what's going to come out. The video has incidences of has testimony about sexual misconduct that was not even charged out. I mean, minimally, that should have been redacted. So are you saying that you're saying this was not error, or that it is harmless error? I mean, we have to look at it one way or the other as a piece of evidence.
Right. I would argue it was an error for the court to allow the video to be played after she testified. And if the court thinks that there was extra in there, I think it would be harmless. Again, I believe she testified of a couple of ways between finger penetration and penis penetration. And that occurred in both, I believe. And so I think that's sufficiently consistent. And again, I think we're being too strict as far as, and this isn't novel to have forensic interviews be presented after a child testifies about sexual abuse.
I can't talk about that, Mr. Banner, as to the allegations that are being charged. So you have a forensic interview that talks about shower incidences, tongue allegations, being restrained, having mouth covered. To me, this seems incredibly prejudicial, because it has nothing to do with the charge. Excuse me, it's related to the charge, but it's not the charge that this person was facing. If nothing else, should that not have been redacted before it was played to the jury?
You know, I don't think so. Again, this is a teenager testifying, and this is part of the reason I think we allow the forensic interviews in, is because of the setting that they're placed in. We don't expect the child to get up on the stand in front of those jurors, in front of the accused, in front of the judge, and go into as much detail on the stand as we do seeing those forensic interviews, because the setting is one-on-one. They're created and geared toward allowing the child to feel safe and free to express all the situations that happen. What we're focused on is, were the allegations made on the stand, the facts, consistent? Not less expansive or more expansive, but those pertinent facts, are they consistent with what she disclosed? Then the fact that she gave more detail there, I don't think makes it inadmissible. Any other questions on that? Just a moment then. And again, I don't believe there was any way that the many of the cases that defense cites to are cases where an evaluation occurred within the case or related to the case in some way. This is a case, again, where this happened so many years in the past. It wasn't related to the case. And as the court indicated, what's the time frame that defense would have to go back into every witness's history to try to find, you know, any evaluations from when they were children? As far as the one more thing, the data practices, I don't think 21.
I think that's why it's the state's burden to produce evidence that may be exculpatory or may be impeachable. I mean, that's the state's
right.
burden.
Sure. No, I understand that. Right. But also, note under Brady, the case I cite there talks about if the defendant has actual or constructive knowledge of the allegedly withheld exculpatory information, there cannot be a Brady violation. And that's Yerby versus State. And I would argue there's at least constructive knowledge, and he demonstrates that throughout.
I don't quarrel with you on that case holding.
Yeah.
What I find fault with is Judge Melby's determination that on a credibility claim that doesn't seem to be encompassing enough in terms of the Brady issue.
Well, I think, like I argued, I think it's pretty evident that he received a copy, and Judge thought the same thing based on the argument that there was no other way he could have had that information on December 30th. There's just no other explanation given. So if we take everything as true that we see, mailed out December 20th to Jeremy Jenkins, That would explain why he knows on December 30th the results before the hearing. That's the only explanation. So we have to take that to infer that that happened. There's no other explanation. The last thing, though, on a release of information was signed by Mr. Jenkins at the office as the parent of the minor child who's being evaluated. I know the defense cites to the Data Practices Act that talks about the limitations. But it's not just by court order under 1305, 13.05 of the statutes. Says private or confidential data may be used and disseminated to individuals or entities specifically authorized access to that data by state, local, or federal law enacted or promulgated after the collection of the data. Those are exceptions. Again, it also includes other things. But if you go to the Minnesota Statute 144, 293, and 294, that talks about release of information to parents. And it makes sense if a child is brought in by a parent to have a mental health evaluation and there's a diagnosis, that parent should be allowed to have a release of information in the meantime if there needs to be treatment or medication or discussion about that. It would be absurd to think that a court rule obligating how courts act would prevent a parent from being able to have the access of their child's medical stuff that may be necessary for them to provide care for them. So I just don't think that it's an absurd result to say that that court rule extends to that situation. And that's my time, sorry.
Thank you very much. And Mr. McLaughlin, you have the last word.
Thank you. Just to begin with the prior consistent statement issue, in our view, there's no way this court can look at the record and think that an error did not occur here. The district court admittedly did not watch the video, the forensic video. Without watching it, the district court could not have conducted the comparative analysis that's required under Bakken and the other case law. So there is error here, and further, this was prejudicial error, and this court has looked at several factors in evaluating whether this type of error had a significant. There's a different possibility to affect the verdict. All of those factors point towards prejudice in this case. First, the manner was presented. The state played the entire video. As you noted, Judge Werke, the state did not redact, or the court did not redact the video. So the jury heard everything. And that included separate instances of sexual conduct that were not alleged by the state, including an incident that happened in the shower, an instance of penetration with involving a tongue that was not included in EJ's trial testimony, and that was totally separate behavior that the jury heard as a result of the court's erroneous introduction of this evidence. The second factor is whether the video was likely to be persuasive, and if trial testimony is more vague, then a more detailed video is more likely to be persuasive. And here we had very vague testimony from EJ at trial, while the narrative provided in the video on the forensic video was much more detailed. So that increased the persuasiveness of the video and the prejudicial effect of its admission. Next factor is the reliance by the prosecutor. Here, the prosecutor emphasized the video in closing. Most of the closing was arguing details contained in the video and not in EJ's sparse trial testimony. And finally, the defense did not effectively counter the video. There's no attack on the video in closing by defense counsel. So, given all of this, there was a high likelihood that the jury used this video improperly as part of its basis for the verdict. So, we'd ask for reversal based on the court's erroneous admission of that evidence.
McLaughlin, do
Yep.
we have any information on the record that indicates when a transcript of the forensic interview was prepared and whether that transcript was reviewed by the court before making its ruling?
I'm not, I can say confidently that the court doesn't make any statement in the record that it reviewed the transcript. I do not know exactly when the transcript was prepared in this case, but the court, there's no indication in the record that the court reviewed it. And at the time of ruling on the defense motion to preclude the jury from viewing this video, the court said, "I didn't even see the video." So, I mean, that statement, it's consistent with the court not knowing the substance of the video, and there's nothing in the record to contradict that. And I believe what some of the statements that Mr. Van Aert was referring to by the court is the court made statements in response to defense counsel's objection. So defense counsel said, you know, the video isn't a prior consistent statement because it provides all these details. It describes penetration in a way that wasn't in the trial testimony. District court summarized the argument by saying something like, so it's not as detailed. Well, I'm not going to admit it, but the court never made any statement that it viewed the video. I think the statements the court did make were in response to defense counsel's objection at trial. Turning briefly to the state's point about how the Brady material would have been used at trial, the Minnesota Supreme Court's case in a decision in Hunt, and also its decision in Spencer really outlines how this evidence could have been used. And in both those cases, the court noted how the defense can use either competency examination or a specific finding that the witness could not had trouble perceiving an event that could be used either through directly questioning the witness, through extrinsic evidence, through other witnesses, which was done in Spencer. And then also in State versus Saldana, another Minnesota Supreme Court case that talks about how expert opinions on this topic is admissible to determine whether a child victim could differentiate reality from fantasy. So either expert testimony, other extrinsic evidence, or direct questioning of EJ, those are all ways the defense could have used this evidence in addition to just directly challenging her competency as a witness. So there's several ways it could have been used by the defense. If the court doesn't have any
other... Your time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for appearing under the remote platform. The matter is submitted and a decision will be issued in a statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor.